Hi, this is Tim Lightfoot, the director of the Huffines Institute. And before we get to the podcast, I wanted to remind you that coming up soon on November the 20th from 1 to 4 p.m. is the annual Huffines discussion. This is our fifth iteration of this great event. We have got some fabulous speakers lined up for you. Go on the website, look at who's coming, and be here. Either be here or be at one of the satellite sites that we list on the website to catch it. Otherwise, you'll wait till January and we'll be putting the videos up at that point. Now, on to the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello, and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I want to thank you all for taking the time to download and listen. As we do every week, we've brought another interesting individual in the world of sports medicine, human performance. We're pitching a big tent today, actually. And you'll learn a little bit more about that. But anyway, we have another interesting, wonderful guest with us today, Dr. Adam Berry from here at Texas A&M. Welcome to the podcast, Adam.
Thanks for having me, Tim.
It's great to have you on. I'm going to tell the audience a little bit about you first, and then we'll just kick into some conversations. Dr. Berry is currently an associate professor here in health and kinesiology. He's in our health education division. He is the chair of the graduate education programs here in our department. He had got his PhD in health education from here at Texas A&M. We didn't keep him, actually. He's gone to a couple other places, but he got his bachelor's and master's in health education from Florida State University initially. He got his PhD in 2007, and the only reason I tell you that is because at this point, this outstanding scholar has already published 68 articles. I don't think he sleeps at all in the meantime. So, I mean, in a total of 8 years, he's got an amazing amount of production. As a matter of fact, it's so amazing, he was actually named the Outstanding New Faculty here at Texas A&M this year. So we're real pleased to have you here and all the words of wisdom that you'll bring with you. Adam's research interests are all alcohol-related.
That's right.
I find alcohol helps my research as well, but that's not the way that you're
not related. Not my research, no, sir.
But in a variety of different ways, harm reduction of alcohol, industry marketing, driving and intoxication, and we could go on with the list, and we're actually going to go on with a little bit of the list. Population primarily is college students and does some military veteran work. So we start off often with, how'd you get interested in this whole area? Is there some, like, tragic background to this that...
It's funny. Usually you talk to addiction counselors or someone that works in the alcohol or addiction field, and they're either overcome addiction themselves or have never touched it. Mm-hmm. And I fall somewhere in the middle, never experienced addiction myself. But I just find alcohol really interesting. Mm-hmm. And when I was at Florida State University as an undergraduate, there was a time that was noted the Princeton Reviews, mm-hmm. top party school in the nation. And so I was around it in college, and then I'd go back home, and I went to a magnet school that was focused on health professions in my high school. And I was exposed to some amazingly smart people in high school, way smarter than I am. It was astounding how smart they were, 1,600 kind of SAT people, just
wow.
Acing everything.
Yeah.
And I'd go back home and on breaks in undergrad, and they'd kind of be bums, weren't really making much of themselves, and it was really disappointing to see. And so that kind of stayed with me, and then came to grad school, and you kind of have to find a topic, you know, relatively early that interests you. And I figured if I could find something that was easy to read about, fun to read about, fun to learn about, it'd kind of make my job easier to do.
Yeah.
And then, you know, have some family history with alcohol use that also kind of gave me some interest. So kind of social, interpersonal factors kind of pushed me that way, and then I was able to kind of find something I like to read about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The media makes a big deal about the amount of alcohol on college campuses in particular. Is that true, or is that media, is it just hype and overblown? Or?
No, I would say it's definitely not overblown. Mm-hmm. So if you look at, like, binge drinking, and mm-hmm. you can argue what's the proper way to define binge drinking, but, you know, the typical way that's been done is four for females on an occasion, five for males on an occasion.
Oh, on per occasion.
Right. So, and then they tried to attach a time frame for that within 2 hours, and then tried to attach a level of intoxication to it. But regardless, just, you know, 4 or 5 drinks basically in a sitting.
Yeah.
So the rate of that in college campuses in 1993, can you guess what that was, Tim?
I will guess rate was 2%.
It was 45%.
Wow.
So about 2010, 2012, what do you think the rate was?
Well, let's go up 75%.
It was 45%.
Oh, still 45%.
Yeah, so we can either go, hey, we're doing such an amazing job that the rate is not going up.
So you can tell the host knows nothing about this.
So I feel really smart. Excellent.
Yeah.
So either we're doing such a bang-up job that nothing's going up and the trend's staying pretty level, or we can say, man, we spent probably billions of dollars on this problem and haven't really made a dent.
Mm.
So in college, you know, you have a time where you're transitioning in life. So a lot of changes are happening. Freedom's happening. You're exposed to a lot of things that maybe you weren't in the cocoon or shelter of home. And so you're out on your own. And so drinking rates definitely raise in college, and it's typically the highest points that they are in someone's life.
Mm.
So they have this thing called developmental alcoholism. So basically, during that period, 18, 24, 25, 26, if you're kind of taking 2 victory laps in your undergraduate, you have people that are drinking at very, very high rates. So they call it developmental alcoholism. But when they leave college, rates drop off tremendously. And so they call it maturing out of problem drinking. So college interests me in terms of alcohol use because it seems to be this environment that is promoting alcohol use. And National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism actually calls it a culture. And so there's something about the culture of college, whether it's, you know, I was walking the halls earlier and saw the John Belushi, or, you know, wearing the college from Animal House, you
mm-hmm.
know, that culture of college that somehow drinking go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of one of the reasons that interests me, but also why I think it's still very much relevant. And so media might say, you know, college students are drinking. And you can say, well, yeah, they're going to mature out. That's no big deal. But from my perspective and why I think harm reduction is important, it's the consequences that go along with it.
Right.
So I don't think you're going to eliminate college students from ever drinking again. But if you can keep them as safe as possible, I think maybe that's where our dent can come in.
When you get to this matured out of the addiction, I don't use all the phrases right, but the mature out of the addiction, once they graduate from college, what are the rates then? You're talking about the rates have been about 45%. How much do they drop?
Oh, they drop pretty significantly. Then you really start to get into some of the social factors and demographic characteristics
right.
that are really going to influence those rates.
Right.
Types of jobs, you know,
sure.
SES, things
sure.
like that.
I'm just trying to get a sense of how much it dropped off. So what is it about the university or college culture that causes that? I know you talked a little bit about John Belushi. And is it because they are coming to grips with their independence and they're able to, you know, students are able to do kind of what they want for the first time and they're experimenting to try it and our lack of responsibilities the next day other than classes?
You're touching on a number of them. I mean, if you want to keep it pretty layperson colloquial, it's the Twisted Sister, we're not going to take it, the Beastie Boys, fight for your right to party mentality a little bit, and I can do what I want, I'm on my own. Some of it is, you know, there's colleges that are pushing to increase, you know, Friday classes, early 8 a.m. Friday classes, because if someone does have something, a responsibility, whether it's school or work related, that might be something that would prevent them from engaging in excessive amounts of alcohol use or even maybe drinking at all. But factors in terms of college that are pertinent to college, but not maybe necessarily pertinent or associated with social institutions outside of college. I mean, one in particular is, you know, athletics.
Mm-hmm.
That's big on campuses, especially one like ours, any
right.
SEC campus, really. Football is sort of a culture, religion, way of life.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of sports medicine, alcohol really overlaps with that when you start to look at what some have dubbed beer and circus, which is alcohol and football.
Yeah, tailgating and all the social aspects that go around the sporting events that we know about.
Sure, and I know there's some campuses. I used to work at an institution in the Big Ten, and, you know, one of the lower Big Ten schools that I was familiar with in terms of football performance, you know, tailgating happened, but not a lot of football game watching happened. So they'd go tailgate outside the stadium but never step foot in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you talked about, and you said a while ago about the universities keeping the students safe during this, and I see harm reduction. That phrase is interesting to me, harm reduction. So what do universities and colleges do to reduce the harm, I guess, and to keep the students safe?
Well, there's a lot of things that are going on.
Yeah.
And so There's actually a document that was just put out called College AIM, College and then capital A-I-M, through the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. And what they did is they took basically any prevention intervention strategy that's used on a college campus and tried to make it so a university president could pick that up and look at, see, is it effective? Is it evidence-based? Yep. Is there anything to support it?
Right.
So when you ask what are campuses currently doing, man, they're doing a lot
of stuff.
Some of it that's just not working, and some of it that has a little bit of evidence-based support, and then others that seem to be effective. But like I said earlier, binge drinking is still around.
Right.
So we're doing everything from sending birthday cards at these window of risk periods, like someone's 21st birthday, which is ineffective. We're doing strategies like online programs, hour and a half, 2 hour interventions where a student comes to campus and that's part of a requirement before they can register their freshman year. There's debate over whether that's effective.
Mm.
I'm of the mindset that an online intervention probably isn't best in terms of changing behavior. Some of our research has pointed out that students will either simply click through it or these intervention videos they're supposed to be watching will be turned on while they go and use the bathroom, make a sandwich, come back when it's over.
Watch football on another TV.
Yeah, so I mean, I tend to think that you have to be present for an intervention to have it work.
Right.
And then there's other things like brief motivational interviewing where you're trying to kind of establish, look, are your behaviors in line with what you want your quality of life to be, with what you think others and the social norms are? And there's a little bit better evidence base to support things like brief motivational interviewing.
Yeah. Now you've talked a little bit about some of the industry marketing. That's some of your research. Does industry target college kids? Is that another factor that drives the drinking rate?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. If you were to go to a bar on a Friday, Saturday night, why do they have young women dressed in Miller Lite outfits passing around Miller Lights or Bacardi outfits passing around free shots to college students?
Not just a distribution outlet?
No, I don't think so. I think there's a little promotion there. The alcohol industry has started to, or has for some years now, tried to present itself as interested in harm reduction or interested in what quote-unquote responsible drinking.
Mm-hmm.
If you've ever seen a beer advertisement, Anheuser-Busch reminds you, please drink responsibly.
Right
after they showed you a party scene and a really raging good time, it looked like. So this dichotomy of what you're saying with your visual verbal cues and then telling me to drink responsibly, what does that mean? And I mean, to have an industry, their goal and their number one priority is revenues.
Mm-hmm.
In order to make more money, they have to sell more products.
Mm-hmm.
They need you to, therefore, drink more. So to have them present themselves as prevention partners is, I think, counterintuitive, especially when you start to look into some of their practices.
Mm.
Do they promote it to college students? I would say absolutely. A few years ago, they came out with a fan can promotion where they took, really top football schools, LSU, University of Texas, and basically had Bud Light cans specific to those campuses. Why are you doing that? Who's that for?
Right.
I mean, it's not for the 50-year-old drinker. It's for the college student. So, yeah, I think they absolutely target college students. And I venture they actually target kids much younger than college.
Well, it's interesting. We talk about this because it strikes me that the legal drinking age, at least in Texas, is 21. I went through school when legal drinking age was 18. And you mentioned earlier that the drinking rates, binge drinking rates, haven't changed over the years, even with the adoption of these higher age limits. Also, because we see freshmen when they're 18, 17, 18, so forth, they can't drink till they're 21, which means they're a junior, third year here.
I graduated 2 weeks after I turned 21.
So I guess my thought is that if the binge drinking rate hasn't changed, the legal drinking age has changed, we still have industry marketing alcohol to all students.
Mm-hmm.
Is it all a moot point? All these programs, should we just not worry about it and let it be and it'll be okay? Or
you're sort of touching on something that is was a hot button issue there for a few years, something called the Amethyst Initiative.
Okay. And tell us about that.
What that was.
I'm just stumbling around blindly here.
Right, you're kicking a lot of things here.
Yeah.
What that was basically a former college president said, look, college drinking's an issue. We need to do something about it. And they were recommending and had like 140-some other college presidents sign on to this initiative that said, we want to lower the drinking age to 18. Mm. So what does that effectively do for college drinking? When you look at, you know, underage drinking, you effectively define it out as a problem. Mm-hmm. You eliminate it because then you go, oh, well, now they're of age. They can drink. And part of the other part of the initiative was trying to say, well, they'll have to do some things to earn this sort of
privilege
or a card to drink. I mean, so the Amethyst Initiative got a fair amount of traction and play in the media. But when you look at sort of alcohol policies, the minimum legal drinking age is one of the ones that has been examined very well, and I haven't come across any literature that doesn't support it. Mm. Simply because when you look at, you could say, well, you know, you went through when it was 18, mm-hmm. and now it's 21. Well, why is that? Well, really, it's because of the alcohol-related traffic.
The driving issues.
Yeah, it was the driving issues. You had alcohol-related traffic fatalities that just skyrocketed because some people are still in high school when they're 18. Mm-hmm. And so you have high schoolers and people with very limited drinking experience and very limited driving experience combining those two things together, which was extremely problematic. And you had just huge spikes. So then the only change that happens is they raise it back to 21, and what happens? Man, rates just go right back down. So
that's certainly something we haven't talked about, is the effect on the driving. I know that's another area of research that you've done is on that. So it's great that you jumped in there with that, because there is a reason for the alcohol related ages. If we're looking at just the rates of drinking, doesn't seem to make a difference. But if you're talking about fatalities mm-hmm. with traffic in mm-hmm. particular,
right?
Now, one of the other things that you hear about sometime is that alcohol is a gateway drug to other things.
That's right.
True? Not true?
Man, so I guess when you talk about gateway drugs, the first thing that comes to mind is what?
Marijuana,
yeah. Reefer madness, right. You know? And so when you talk about gateway drugs, some people are just immediately sort of roll their eyes a little bit because right. they think back to that reefer madness. And then others who go, you know, true gateways are this sort of linear progression. But the research has been sort of mixed, where some say it's marijuana, some say no, the gateway is tobacco, others say it's alcohol, and I'm one of the others that say it's actually alcohol. Mm. So if you look at when people actually initiate their very first substance use, alcohol is the first substance the vast majority use. Any national studies that we've done, alcohol is one of the first substances that are ever used, and typically it's initiated around 6th, 7th grade. And wow. So that's problematic, because the earlier someone drinks, the more likely they are to develop alcoholism, alcohol dependence later in life. So we talked about minimum legal drinking age earlier. Right. 21's no magic number. I know people in their 30s I wouldn't trust to watch my dog, right? Much less, you know, handle their alcohol. So right. 21's not a magic number, but the longer you delay to 21, the more likely you will not become dependent on alcohol later in life. So there is research support that 21, or at least delaying, is good. So the earlier you initiate, the more problematic that is. And typically, you don't see people that use heroin as the first substance they've ever done. You don't see people that are using cocaine as the first substance they've ever done. More people follow a linear progression of alcohol, tobacco, marijuana than they do tobacco, alcohol, marijuana, or marijuana, alcohol, tobacco. So, yeah, the progression of alcohol first is actually, from the national studies we've done and looked at, that's the first substance people are typically using. So when you think about schools,
right.
they've got limited, you know, when I talk K-12, you've got a limited budget.
Right.
So perhaps why don't you focus that money on delaying the initiation of alcohol versus smoking cessation or even DARE, which right. isn't that effective anyway. Focus your resources and time there, because if you can delay alcohol use, you're probably more likely to delay other substance use as well.
Stuff. Yeah. Wow. Interesting stuff. So before we get out of here, we have to talk a little bit about activity, physical activity. It almost goes without saying that if someone is drinking alcohol, they certainly cannot perform at their best.
No.
When we talk about sports, recreation, or anything like that.
Well, yes, depending on how much they're drinking and what type of movement you're talking about.
Okay, so tell us about the gray area here then.
Let's say you and I, we want to go to the gym. Okay. We've had a long day. Let's leave work and we're going to go bench press. Okay? That's what full profs and associate profs usually do together.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. And there's a good thing there's not video with this, because they can see how much we really do bench press, usually.
I'll flex right now and show everyone.
Okay.
So let's say we say, okay, we're going to go hit up the gym, but before that we're going to go have two beers. We have two beers and we go to the gym. that's not going to prevent us from lifting a bar up and down.
Right.
It will impact our fine motor skills, though. But you're not doing real fine motor movements when you talk about just lifting a barbell.
Right.
So alcohol does absolutely impact performance, but depending on what performance we're talking about. If you talk about driving, for instance, any deviation from zero is starting to influence your driving skills, because that is very much fine motor skills and tracking and keeping a car straight.
Yeah.
So I think you asked earlier about alcohol and activity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if I were to ask you, who do you think drinks more, people who are inactive or people who are active?
I would guess people that are inactive.
I would say you are wrong.
Okay. Excellent. So, I love being wrong.
People who drink, from what we've found, is people who drink are more active. And there seems to be this almost linear dose-response relationship, whereas activity increases, drinking increases.
Hmm.
So when we talk about college students specifically,
yeah,
we found that drinking's going to happen. Hmm. And so they recognize that, man, alcohol's got a fair amount of alcohol-related calories in it, and I'm concerned with how I look, my athletic abilities. So some have said, I'm going to work out to kind of earn my drink, so do this proactive, you know, extra activity to create this caloric deficit that they'll then fill with alcohol. Some have said, I'm going to drink my dinner. I'm not going to eat at all, recognizing that I will be drinking alcohol. And, you know, if you look at a Bud Light, it's probably about 120 calories. So if someone says, I'm going to have 5 Bud Lights tonight, that's 600 calories.
Yeah, you have to walk 5 miles to get rid of that.
And that's more than a Big Mac.
Yeah.
So this relationship between alcohol and activity is really interesting, because college students have said, we're not going to give up our alcohol, so we're gonna engage in these proactive and reactive behaviors, and reactive being I'm going to, you know, kind of binge and purge.
Sure.
Because I still want to make sure I drink.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So as regular listeners of our podcast know, this is the time we usually give our guests to give us their take-home message. What's the one thing you want people to remember after they've heard this podcast?
So the few take-home points I'd say is we'll sort of break them down here. Okay. In terms of individually, it's important to be cognizant of your drinking. So
none of us would deny that, that's
no,
for sure.
Absolutely not. And so it's important to also recognize that it can sometimes become just habit, and you sort of turn your mind off a little bit to it. So it's important to kind of think through about your own. And I'd also recommend for those who want to engage in sport, or anyone really, to make sure that you are sort of treating your body well. Make sure you're taking days off, right? Just like when you work out, you need to take days off, let your muscles rest. I'd recommend that people take days off from drinking, and not just recovery days, but just actually try and abstain for a day every now and then. So you don't make it a habitual everyday thing where it can lead to some negative consequences.
Excellent. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Very informative. And as everyone knows, at this point in the podcast is when we have one of our producers come on and give us the podcast question of the week. So here with the podcast question of the week is our producer, Kenneth.
What did Dr. Barry say was the percentage of people in college that had binge drank in the past 2 weeks?
Great podcast question. Be the first one to send us the email response with the correct answer. Send it to Huffines Podcast at hlkn.tamu.edu. Be the first one to respond with the correct answer, and we'll send you one of our nifty podcast t-shirts. Don't think you're too late to respond. We've been known to give away bonus t-shirts as well. So go ahead and respond. Reach out. Let us hear from you. So again, thank you all for taking the time to download and listen. Adam, thank you for taking time today to be with us.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening.
Had a great time with the podcast. We hope that all of you tune in next week when we interview another interesting individual from the world of sports medicine and the extended world of human performance. And until then, we want you and we hope that you are active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Aidlett Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sidney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by JohnMilesProductions.com.
If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.